accession number 27226, reel 18.
Line a hook, reel 18.
Yeah.
What flying gear did you wear while you were flying?
You tripped the switch because I was going to deal with that. I wasn't. Before that, the boys had all come out, we all did it, flew in the air with no clothes on, no top cover, but we had a parachute on, of course, Mae West and everything else, so we had a measure of protection. But it was still crazy to fly bare completely. And what we did immediately after that exercise was everybody went down to the local tailor in the village and had a white suit made of local cloth, complete a working, you know, a work suit,
an overall,
and everybody flew in those from then on. Very comfortable way to fly, because you've put the mosquito boots on, tuck them into your mosquito boots, and they were light and airy, and the rest of the time you're covered all the way up your arms. If you had any sense at all, you wore silk gloves anyway, for no other reason than it was a good idea, and so you were pretty well covered all the way. You had a face mask, oxygen mask, goggles, which people sometimes wore and some didn't, but basically you got an overall protection then against a flash, because the worst thing that can happen is a thing going pshomf, and then burning everybody, burning all the open places. But if you do that, that's taken, and we wore those forever. Wherever every squadron I went to afterwards, if they hadn't had white, they all flew in white overalls with mosquito boots. They didn't all have mosquito boots. We were lucky. We managed to pinch a pair in West Africa, and they stayed with us for the rest of the time. But they're super to fly in, light and airy, and for mess work, you know, you were nice and cool. So,
you mentioned as well that obviously that when the accident occurred, he was carrying depth charges, and you mentioned how you would go out on patrol. Would the Swordfish always be carrying depth charges, or would you sometimes carry...
They were always my... That was probably why... I never thought of that aspect of it, but that's probably why he did his first trip, because all the aircraft were always armed up with depth charges and parked with depth charges on. They were never taken down. So, I never thought about that. If they wanted to do any exercises with the army or anything like that, the depth job is off, of course, but... Basically, I think they were always armed there with. That's probably why he did his first trip. And I never thought of that aspect of it before. But it was a silly thing to do.
When you were using the depth charges, because obviously, if you were going to attack a submarine, although the opportunity didn't arise, what was the technique for dropping a depth charge on a submarine?
Oh, well, there's no problem about that. We did all that at Arbroath. You fly at a low level, probably 100 feet. If you know the submarine's there, and mind you, you would only be able to see a shadow in the water unless it got a feather up with it. That was what you were looking for most of the time. But if it was submerged, you could see the shadow of the submarine. And if you had a feather, well, you flew over it in the direction he was going, and flew over it and passed him, and dropped two depth charges in front of the thing. A reasonable distance, I think about probably from time dropping to going down, probably about 150 to 200 yards, I would think, something of that order. But the depth charge we were using were 500 pounders, and they were okay for the traditional submarine, you know. But once you got against the Japanese, the big ones, they would just bounce off the pressure holes. And we were later on involved with the I-27 in the Indian Ocean. And if we'd have ever got caught up, but we didn't, they would have just been no good at all. They would have not have made any real damage. They'd be shaking it a bit, but that's about as far as it had gone.
Did they have depth settings for them?
I don't know. I haven't the faintest idea. All I did was drive the things, and presumably the people who were responsible for it never thought about it. You know, I did. Got the aircraft flying along. I had to drop the depth charge if there was any problem about it, And that was it. As far as I was concerned, it was stuck on the wings, and I came back with it on. Didn't drop it anywhere.
You mentioned something about the climate earlier on in Hastings. Did this affect flying conditions at all?
Only the weather. But we were there in the early days before the rainy season really started. That was when the rainy season started, when I told you about early on. I never found flying in West Africa anything of a problem at all. The air was always clear. Never had any difficulties about weather or clouds or rainstorms or anything like that. They never really produced a problem, but I can't think of any situations where cloud was ever a problem. Later on it could be, because of course when it really got tropical, it was, you get in the cumulonimbus there, if you got into one of those, you're in serious strife. So you kept away from them. Then we could see them, of course, so if they were there, you avoided them.
And I was quite interested in that you were describing the airfield. What was the runway surface made of?
Tarmac. It was a tarmac, it was a straight tarmac surface, in one direction only. That was down towards the mangrove swamp. I don't know whether that was east. That would be, I think, virtually north and south, but don't quote me on that. But there was just one runway, and at the far, what I call the far end of the runway, where the mangrove swamps, that's where the secondary runway, which was in fact a track which went up to the camp, was never used as a runway at all. You always land on that one, and wind didn't ever seem to be a problem. We could, if the wind was wrong, you just landed, crabbed in a little bit, and dropped down. It's fairly straightforward. It didn't pose a real problem.
Is there anything else about your time there that comes to mind?
Well, stop it a minute. One aspect of Freetown, which is of interest, was that the depot ship for the Navy was the Edinburgh Castle, which is moored in the harbour, and was death and disaster. First of all, it was a sweatship. It was below decks. It was always hot and steamy and uncomfortable. It wasn't clean. There were rats. It had everything wrong about a ship. And in point of fact, it was the place where you sent recalcitrant troops if they misbehaved themselves. If they got 7 days or 10 days, that's where they would go. And that was dreaded. You got discipline from the Edinburgh Castle by saying to any of the troops, well, if you don't very well behave, you'll go on the Edinburgh Castle. That was a fearsome place to go to, because it was just horror. And in fact, it stayed there. It was still there after we left. And that's, we're talking now, 43, aren't we? And it was, after we left, it was taken out to sea. It was, and I believe it went out on its own steam to sea. That must have been an interesting exercise if it had been moored all the way along that time. Or else it was towed out, and it was sunk by gunfire by one of the battle cruisers passing by. And I've covered that in the book, as the ignominy of but it was the best thing that had happened, you know, and it got rid of a lot of rats as well. I never went on board it at all. But I knew by its reputation that it was pretty, pretty horrible. That's the Edinburgh Castle. It was not the place to go into, be a tent sent to, anything like that. And there were people living on board it as well. Life aboard must have been appalling.
So how did your time in West Africa come to an end?
Well, it came to an end with my relief arriving. Because when a reef arrived, he was killed. So what do you do? Well, first of all, we, as a result of the rain, the rugby field hadn't got any grass or soil on it at all. We still played rugby and football with the natives, and Jack Dyson, my mate, managed to break his arm, so he was ready to go with a broken arm. That was one aspect of it, and then the three of us were waiting for the relief to find some way of getting somebody to replace the one that was killed. And this was taken, I had to hand over my trading empire to this New Zealander lad, who really didn't like it. I spoke to him after the war, and he wasn't very keen on running this sort of horrible system that I had established. And he passed out to a pal of mine who I met later on, a Welshman actually, and he said he took it over and he ran it for a long time afterwards, probably another 5 or 6 months when it closed down. So I was doing good for everybody, really. So that was alright. We just left. Gave the sailors farewell. We weren't very happy at staying in Freetown, but it was it's supposed to be a white man's grave, but it was not wasn't a grave if you looked after it well. It was a comfortable one. You fed well, it was warm, you could always go swimming. One problem with swimming, of course, were the Portuguese men of war. Has anybody told you about these? If you really want to know what swimming in the tropical seas are like, swim off West Africa. A Portuguese man of war is a floating jellyfish, and trailing alongside it is tentacles which can be 100 yards long, and they are rather like frog spawn but very thin, all connected together, and if you swim into those it wraps round your leg. It's full of a very unpleasant poison, which when you get done with it, the pain is absolutely horrendous. And if you get one, it hurts, but if you get the lot, and it looks as though somebody had been round your leg with a sewing machine, all evenly spaced all the way around. And that was one of the problems with swimming in Freetown. And you couldn't keep them away. They came on shore, they were blown inshore if the wind was wrong, and inevitably somebody got caught with one of those things, and it was nasty. Very unpleasant indeed. And very dangerous. Very dangerous, of course, because the pain was excruciating. It went up to your groin as well. It was, it sort of went up to your legs. Ugh. But we used to swim just the same. We didn't worry too much. The boys, we used to go to a village, a native village in Freetown, to go swimming off their beach, away from the main beach. We used to get in the car, and Monty used to take us. We had our own car, so we could go all over the place anyway. And this village there, and one thing about that was, if you got stung, those boys had some leaves that they could rub up your leg and take the pain away. But you didn't know that at the main beach where we were swimming, but they knew. And they used to climb up coconut trees to get coconuts down, like monkeys. And when they came down, they would do this. Put their arms around the tree and fell all the way down and never hurt themselves. Unbelievable. How they did it, I don't know. But they would see the top of the tree and inside they've done not they just put their arms around the tree and drop. And they come to the bottom, probably so they took the shock in the legs, but they never got torn or anything like that. Well, we used to do all sorts of things there. We did gunnery shoots, the West African Frontier Force. And this was a clever piece of exercise, which is bloody dangerous, because you flew in a straight line up and down off the shore with two gunners, one at either end, to fly at you. But they didn't fly at you. They pointed straight at you, because the way you were flying, they'd always miss you. It's known as a layoff shoot. So that's fine. You've got two people, two guns, either end of a thing, and you're flying a straight line. What happens when this bloke fires on the wrong way? Think about it. Instead of his firing, he's aiming for you, and you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it don't hit you. But there's all bits and pieces. Joe Dyson came back with a chunk out of his exhaust manifold, making a horrible noise. You know, it was hazardous, but those are the things we did. A bit of fun. We had smoke bombs for taking wind finding. So when we came back, it was a bit of a joy and fun. We used to dive bomb an old wreck that was in the harbour and see how we could get it. That was an interesting one. We had a job to do. We were also under the control of the RAF, who had other jobs to do that gave us. And once we had a ship came in bringing refrigerators, and it was up top deck, and it was in the harbour, and it was the refrigerators were stolen, and they were on the way down, and they sent us to try and find these boys on a boat going down to Liberia. And that was one thing. Another thing we had to do was to do a photo, an overlap photo, of the top of a series of hills outside Freetown, because for the what they call the Kissy pipeline. That was the sort of job we did. We did anything and everything. There was for women, there were no women. The first night we were there, we were all dressed up in our finery with wings up and everything. I thought we'd go to the nurse's place up in the hills somewhere. It was behind the beach. And we got there, there were two nurses in this place, all of us. Nobody was dancing, the girls were dancing themselves and everything else. And that was the limit of our, really, social contacts. Women were just not available at all. There weren't any.
Just a little silly story to finish off Freetown was that one of the things women always wanted when you're away were prezzies. And we thought a crocodile skin would be a good thing for a handbag. And so we thought that the one thing to do was to go into the mangrove swamps in a canoe and see if we could see one, not knowing that there weren't many, many crocodiles there. Well, there are, but you can't find them. And I was told later on that if you want to go there, you go at night and with a torch and a rifle, and you shine the torch. If you see two little lights ahead of you, fire into the middle of them, and that's a crocodile. That's by the way, but we're after a crocodile, and that is the only relation to this and the crocodile is a bit of sharp shooting that you won't believe. But we're sitting, I had this gun that I told you about underneath the pillar with 4 or 5 bullets as well, and if you ever fired a 4 or 5, you know that it's not possible to hit a barn door 6 foot away because it moves a little bit. It's a bit of a fierce kit, really. So I'm here in this canoe with two native boys looking around for a crocodile, and there was the what we call shiteherks, what they call the birds that fly over the potato?
Vultures.
The ones that were in West Africa weren't even tidy like vultures. They were rough, horrible things. And I'm sitting there trying, with this gun in my hand, looking for a crocodile. And there's one of these vultures comes over. I said, so the boys, there we are. That's what you do. And I fired at this vulture. And I hit it. I didn't hit it dead. It didn't fall to pieces, it just stopped dead in the air with its wings wide open and glided down into the mud. And the boys jumped out into this mud, up to the hips in mud, because that to them was very good chop, master, very good chop indeed. But also, from then onwards, I was the marksman of the world, you know, I could shoot birds down with this gun. But can you imagine, you know, if you talk to anybody who's ever fired a 4-5, and tried to hit anything with it, and I deal with that later on, probably at Whale Island later on. It's just uncontrollable. It's one hell of a piece of kit, and you can't, you know, cowboys can't shoot somebody riding into the sun over 200 yards away, that's for sure. Anyway, that's an anecdote for what it's worth. I can't think of anything else about West Africa just off the top of my head, but I went back later on anyway, so if I do think of anything else when I go back to the Gold Coast about, 6 months later or so later, I'll tell you. Had it done.
So how did you move on again then from West Africa?
Well, there we went, we got the Stirling Castle, another luxury ship, to go down to Cape Town to go to Mackinnon Road, which was the Fleet Fighter Pool at Mackinnon Road. Which was in a nice place. Billet Simonstown was the place to go to. And we set off for a four-day journey or a three-day journey, whatever it was, in absolute luxury. The Stirling Castle was still a luxury liner. There was nothing else. And on board, strangely enough, was a Polish girl whose father was the chief of police of the Polish corridor. She was rather nice, but she had a jewel scar down the side of her face. I always remember her. And I took up with her because she was quite a nice, you know, there was a social environment. And she was actually travelling down to go to her aunts who lived outside Cape Town, between Cape Town and Muizenberg. And I could never understand how these people could travel from England in a ship like the Stirling Castle to go to South Africa in the middle of a war. I still don't understand how it came about. But she ended up in Cape Town, and that in itself was a sojourn, because we were supposed to be in the fighter pool. When we got there, as is now par for the course for the next 20 minutes, they closed it down. There was nobody there at all. So they put us into a holding camp, which was nothing but tin huts and everything else. I don't even know where the food came from, because I don't think I ever had any food there. And we were in Cape Town for a week or 10 days, at least. This girl was my girlfriend. Jack Dyson, Shorty Curran and I were stuck there in this place, not flying, no social activities at all. We hadn't seen any women for a long time, and we were a bit, what to do about it. Though I was all right with, I had a Polish girlfriend, so that was good. But the first thing we sought to do was, well, we'll have a go and look where we can get some drink, liquor. Now, I don't drink, but they drank. So we wandered all over the place, and we found a place that would sell gin. I remember two gins they had, a pink gin or something. It wasn't pink, it was something else. They bought two bottles of this stuff and picked up with two girls, and we went to the three of us and three girls went to the Delmonico place in Cape Town. Now, to this day, I cannot recall whether that place had a roof over the top or not, but apparently it had, because all the lights, the little stars in the sky, were in the roof. I remember that so well. And Jack Dyson and Shorty, they went back to the camp. And I took this girl for a cup of coffee at her aunt's coffee place in Cape Town. And this was, about dark night. And we went to this rather nice coffee shop. Chromium plated, quite modern, quite pleasant, to go in for a cup of coffee and whatever happens. And I remember I walked into this place, and she switched the light on, and the wallpaper moved. It disappeared. The place was covered in cockroaches. Wall to ceiling and cockroaches. I never had a cup of coffee in that place. Never went in again, ever. But that was the most shock-making experience. They're all over like wallpaper and they switch the light on and they and disappear completely. Quite a frightening experience in its own way. We had a little bit interlude on with the girl, because I was it's now in there was the tail end of that winter. Muizenberg was a holiday resort, and it was just like an English holiday resort in winter. It was empty.
So we're looking at summer. English summer,
yes. We're getting to June, of course, so it's right in the middle of their winter. And this girl was a very nice Polish girl. She was quite well educated in all things sexual and otherwise. And I took up with her, and we went on the railway line train to Muizenberg. And Muizenberg was quite convenient from where we were to Muizenberg, which is a holiday resort, and her aunt lived in a place just off there. And it's all rather hazy now, but the story's there. I wrote it down a long time ago. And can you imagine a situation where we're going to... How we were there, I don't know, but... We're across a bridge in a park, a bridge over water, and we're snogging, and the wood gave way, and we both fell into the water. Middle of winter, in South Africa, soaking wet, absolutely saturated. She was drenched, and I was soaked as well. I mean, I was, I don't know what I was wearing. I must have been in civvies. It must have been, but it doesn't make any matter. But we had to get back onto the train to take her back to her aunt's place. And I had to deliver this girl to her aunt's, absolutely soaking wet with transparent clothes and everything. You see, everything she had in this train with other people wondering what had happened. I was soaking wet, she was soaking wet. And she went into the house and I never saw her again. Rather like the girl in Canada, you know, the Kingston Penitentiary. But she was very nice, and I often wonder what ever happened to her. She was a nice kid. But we came back, and then we were always told we had to report back to base. We could go where we liked, stay where we liked, do what we liked, as long as we're back in the camp at 8 o'clock every morning in case the draft came. And the draft came, and Jack and I were there, but Shorty Colonel got adrift. But he came back, he got back in time, and we went on the blue train. Left the blue train from Cape Town to Johannesburg and Durban to catch a ship in Durban to go up to Mombasa, which was the next fleet fighter pool. The war having moved from that part of the world and the southern Atlantic really to the war coming back to go to the east.
So there was a general shift at that time?
Complete shift, yes. The Battle of the Atlantic wasn't over by any means, but it had quietened down to the extent that the war that was important was the one to getting back into India and Burma and Ceylon, and Burma war was quite hot. And so we were sent up to go to the Fleet Fighter Pool at McKinnon Road in Kenya. We arrived there to find that Godfrey Parish was there, a pal of mine, with all the aircraft, all the Hurricanes, and they were just about to leave. They were going to Ceylon to form the fighter pool at Putlam in Ceylon. So we arrived at McKinnon Road with just the three of us, a skeleton staff, a captain, an RN captain, who spent his time shooting lions or trying to shoot, never shot a lion, by the way, in the bush. We're living in bashes, which were open-fronted places with straw, just nothing to do, very little to do, and I think that is probably a good place to stop, because that in itself is an interesting series of stories, a little bit to do with the Navy and flying, but also the situation of Kenya, the Lord Merrill's murder, the relics of the Italian campaign, where we had an Italian commander actually taken back to England to be examined, and so on and so forth. So